This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Some call it a post-truth society. With increased media consolidation, fake news, and plummeting trust in media, what needs to be done to solve our epistemological crisis? With us are two experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. His latest book is called Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Victor Picard also joins us. He's a professor of communication at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Media Activism in the Digital Age. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you both back with us. Really important times for both of your areas of study, particularly now with media. I think we are in what, Victor, you have called a misinformation age, or you said society, but I would say misinformation age. I wonder if we should start, Victor, with your analysis of how we got here.
Sure. I think this situation we're in right now, which, as you noted, I characterize as a misinformation society, has happened gradually. There certainly have been historical reasons that led us to this current predicament. But I think what happened and why we're talking about it more now is that the election of Donald Trump brought into focus a number of structural pathologies in our media system. I think we're just now, as a society, beginning to reckon with some of these systemic problems, whether we're talking about the proliferation of so-called fake news or misinformation, as well as the tendencies for our mainstream news media system to sensationalize politics and important policy issues. So I think if there is a silver lining, right now, at least more people are aware of these problems, and we're beginning to talk about potential structural ways to fix these problems.
You said it happened gradually, but your work suggests that there were a few major things that happened that led us down this path. What would you say those major things are?
Sure. I would pinpoint to two general areas. I would point out that the what's sometimes referred to as the journalism crisis is a worsening problem where we are losing actual public service journalism. So in other words, there are fewer reporters covering important issues, things like elections and policy problems. So that's a supply problem where the news content is gradually being diminished. Then we also have more of an infrastructure problem where increasingly the actual pipes and channels and media flows are being controlled by fewer and fewer corporations. So this is a monopoly problem that, again, if I were to be cautiously optimistic, I think we're beginning to address this, at least at the discursive level. At least we're beginning to talk about this problem where media monopolies have too much power in society.
Bob Entman, do you agree with this assessment?
Well, I guess I'd point out in terms of what Victor was talking about is change factors, that it's not just change in technology or change in markets, it's also a change in policy that's driven this. So the deregulation of the media, the almost complete abandonment of antitrust policy until, ironically, recently, the Trump administration decided specifically to look into the acquisition of CNN is one factor. I also think, yes, we're beginning to talk about the problem of control, but the self-reinforcing power system now, where smaller and smaller numbers of people and corporations together can influence the political process, makes it hard to do more than talk. And it remains to be seen whether the pressure from below is going to be responded to in any way by the current government. It's possible with the change in government, we might see some differences. But I think we're talking about some structural changes actually in the power, the way power flows, not just the way information flows.
So to me, it seems there are bigger problems in which the economic model fits into? I mean, I think we have bigger existential problems right now beyond the economic ownership. Part of this is, of course, I mean, there's a new trend of A, billionaires buying their own publications, which is counter to what we have historically seen. But there's also this proliferation of truly fake news. And I think combined with what we have been doing as media scholars in rightfully criticizing the economic model and rightfully criticizing the coverage of things, I fear that we have given a platform to somebody like Donald Trump to then be able to say it's all fake news whenever there's accuracy. Victor Picard, what do you think?
I do agree that the gradual weakening of our news media institutions have left them vulnerable to these kinds of exploitation. And to be a little more specific, I think the commercial imperatives that have been driving our news media for so long, but as they face economic crisis, in some ways these pressures have even worsened, has led them to sensationalize, has led them to gradually lose the public's trust. And it has become easier for opportunists like Donald Trump to step in and dismiss professional news media as being fake news. And that is one problem. And I think you're also identifying another problem, that as these news organizations become weakened and devalued economically, they're easy pickings for politicos who have particular agendas to buy them up. And we're seeing that with newspapers, but we're also seeing that with further media conglomeration and media concentration. Exhibit A I would point out would be the rise of Sinclair Broadcast Group. They are in the process of merging with Tribune and will soon, if it goes through, and everyone assumes that it will, they'll be reaching over 70% of American households. So these are just a couple of examples where, yes, I think the economic crisis have left news organizations vulnerable to these political opportunistic problems. And I agree with Bob. It's going to take policy intervention to change this.
Bob Entman, what about the handing of the platform to somebody like Donald Trump to then devalue what might be truly real as fake news? Have we contributed to that platform that he has?
Well, in the sense that the mainstream media, which, as Victor says, have suffered economic losses and confidence losses, they're now in a position where I think you have two real problems. One is the false equivalence, so that you had reporting during the 2016 campaign in which Trump's scandals were treated as actually less serious than Clinton's for a variety of technical reasons. But this equivalence traces to this marginalization, the fear of the mainstream media of these economic and trust issues. So you've got a weakness that has led them to abandon opportunities to correct a lot of these misimpressions from fake news. And actually, they could be increasing their own legitimacy if they did more reporting on the facts. Let me take a specific example. You turn CNN on at almost any hour, what they will be talking about is Donald Trump. And what they'll be talking about is the politics around Donald Trump and maybe the Russia scandal a little bit. But they won't be talking about very much about the policy issues, the policies that Donald Trump is making, the many forms of corruption that are on a pretty clear view if you discuss it and point it out. And these are things that would make people, I think, both less susceptible to Trump's propaganda, which I think is very skillful. And I think he deserves actually more credit for being a skilled communicator than he gets. But it would delegitimize some of that and would give people more information on which to criticize and reject fake news.
I'm glad you brought up the scandal, because we have seen quite a bit of coverage on money laundering, what appears to be obstruction of justice, what appears to be a conspiracy. And you started to assess how the media have been covering these scandals. And it sounded like you gave them like a D. What would you say?
Well, I think they're doing a better job now than they did during the election campaign. So if you're talking about empowering Trump, you're really talking about his ability to manipulate the mainstream media as well as the digital media during the campaign to pay so much attention to Hillary Clinton's email so-called scandal and to distract attention from investigating his own. This combines, I should say, with another important factor in all of these crises, which is the change in the nature of our party system. The media rely heavily on the two parties and competition between the two parties. If one of those parties begins to abandon the norms that have governed the political process, you're really rendering the media less able to provide balanced coverage. An example of this abandoning the norm is the, and this is not about Donald Trump simply, but it's about things like the Republican National Committee and other prominent Republicans accepting Roy Moore as, and supporting Roy Moore as a candidate. This is an illustration of their leaving behind norms that used to govern political discourse and then enabled us to have a more balanced discussion of reality.
One of the other things that you've talked about, Bob Entman, and looking at media's coverage of important scandals versus not so important scandals or things that might not even really rise to the level of scandal, you've also talked about cover-up and using attacks on the media to essentially defend oneself. It seems like Donald Trump is doing that as well to discredit what might be true in a cover-up of the scandal. Are you analyzing this at this point, too?
Yeah, well, I am analyzing particularly the campaign. But I guess I'd also point out that I think the media are pretty much doing quite a bit about the Trump scandals. However, what we have is a Congress that is really not interested in pursuing these. The whole story of Watergate and the whole enormous myth around Watergate and the great way that the system triumphed by getting rid of Nixon and his corruption was rooted in a system in which both Republicans and Democrats actually wanted to get to the bottom of the situation. We don't have that now. We don't have, for example, major hearings for television to be covering. And in the absence of that, you have a very different situation in the possibility that the cover-up could succeed, at least for a very long time. I think it's important for Americans and others around the world to recognize we're in a new political world, not just because of the media factors that Victor talked about, but these political system factors.
So then, given the low trust in media and in government, and this, I guess the Economist called it a post-truth society, or what Victor is calling a misinformation society, and all of the other factors coming into this, the fake news sites, the billionaires buying up the media, net neutrality, and what's happening to that, is the toothpaste out of the tube, or is this fixable? Victor Picard?
Well, I haven't given up hope that the problem is fixable, or at least we can make it less of a problem. And I think the first step will be, again, to raise awareness around some of these issues and get people to think beyond the, you know, many of the factors that Bob was just discussing are kind of symptomatic characteristics in our news media. They're being driven by these commercial values. I mean, for example, the fact that they're so fixated on Donald Trump's latest tweet, I mean, that's irresistible for advertising-driven news media. That spikes. That's inherently controversial. It drives ratings. And that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump is so ubiquitous in our news media. So I think if we start connecting these dots and show the structural reasons behind this kind of media content, we can begin to imagine a different kind of media system And that's one where I think it needs to be less reliant on these market-based mechanisms. We have to start envisioning a more public-oriented media system, whether we're talking about protecting net neutrality or having a fully funded public media system. I think that's where the debate needs to go.
Well, I would generally agree with you. And the reason I asked if the toothpaste is out of the tube is because I don't see that happening in the U.S. And I see other countries following on the heels of the U.S. with this so-called liberalization of media, where even the BBC is struggling to, you know, continue its old path of this public service kind of broadcasting. And then you add to that all of the discrediting sites. The alt-right is creating their own web. We're speaking all different languages. We don't agree on basic realities. The fundamental purveyor of truth, which is science and scholarship, is getting thoroughly shredded in those other spheres. So, you know, I'm acting a little bit alarmist, perhaps, but I see this as a major existential crisis. Bob Entman, what do you think?
Well, when I look around the world, I do see it as a crisis. I do see liberal democratic institutions under assault by a lot of these forces we've talked about, as well as by opportunistic politicians and parties. I don't know whether to say I'm optimistic. I don't think that's right. But I also think, first of all, that Victor is absolutely right that there needs to be discussion of real public media and the value of that to democracy, the indispensable nature of that. But second of all, that there is hope in using the web and digital technologies to organize people, get people out to vote, to inform them to some degree. And we do see in the Alabama election result that it is possible. We also saw in Bernie Sanders' campaign the use of the internet to organize and also to raise money that allowed him to mount a campaign that was pretty much the equal of Hillary Clinton's in financing. This is a very important lesson and model for going forward for future political organizing. So there are some counter forces here.
Really important points, Bob Entman. So, Victor Picard, let's go back to you. One of the things that you've actually been writing about, too, is net neutrality. Walk us through what's at stake.
Yes. Well, I think it's very apt to turn to net neutrality, especially after Bob listed, I think, correctly, all of these democratic potentials that the internet holds, especially for activists and dissident groups and journalists as well. But we lose some of that democratic potential if we are to lose net neutrality protections. Net neutrality sounds very wonky and technical, but it's a very simple safeguard for the internet, which basically ensures that your internet service provider cannot censor political speech or just general expression online, that your internet service provider, whether it's Comcast or Verizon, cannot slow down or block online content, cannot create a tiered internet. And we've taken this for granted for many years. But if we were to lose net neutrality, it would radically change the basic logic of the internet. The struggle for net neutrality will not end at that moment. And shortly thereafter, it's expected to go to the courts, where I actually think activists have a good chance of winning it back. I think this decision will likely be viewed by the courts as being arbitrary and capricious, which means that a regulatory agency cannot simply switch a rule every time a new administration comes into power. So I think there's reason that we may still prevail, but it's going to take a lot of struggle from below as well as victory in the courts.
The other thing I'm really interested in hearing your take on, both of you, pertains to this idea of media literacy. Very sophisticated people, educated people, are really distrusting fundamental facts because they have come from what we would call traditional media. What do you do to increase media literacy and the ability to discern the fake from the real in a general population? Victor, why don't you start?
Sure. I think whenever we talk about media literacy, there's often an assumption that this should be part of our educational curriculum, that it's something that we should be teaching in our schools. And I certainly agree with that. I also would go further to say that, and this speaks against some of the cynicism that I think rightfully is seeping into our conversation about the future of journalism. But right now, there is this newfound appreciation for the Fourth Estate. Many people are seeing it as an essential defense against everything from fake news to fascism. So I do think we are in an opportune moment to expand our media literacy efforts. And I think part of this, not to repeat myself, but I think part of this is to understand some of these structural relationships behind the news in order to understand why news covers issues in a particular way.
Bob Entman.
Well, absolutely, that the literacy, analytical thinking, appropriate skepticism without total distrust of science and scholarship and real journalism. All of these are things that we would like people to understand and look out for. We do have, unfortunately, elites in the United States, and I don't know about elsewhere, attacking public education and trying to weaken public education. We have a tax bill in which the graduate students of the United States are facing enormous increases in the cost of their education, which means teachers and professors are being attacked. So there are efforts to kind of undermine literacy of all forms. And I think that needs to be more on the table, that we really ought to be discussing how public education and education generally are under assault from a large component of the leaders of our society. And, you know, if education's weakened, it's going to be harder to inculcate media literacy.
So just to bring a little cynicism back, Victor Picard, sorry. And what Bob Entman just talked about in terms of the what the Republicans have put forward on the tax bill, we've talked about the structural problems. We've said, look, we need a policy change. I don't see that happening with the current government. I didn't see it happening with the previous government or several previous ones before. What I'm wondering is, not saying that this can't change, but the current body in power thrives on this lack of education and the lack of literacy. Their power is based on this. So why would they give up any of it? And we are relying on grassroots to potentially challenge that. But I see a sort of clinging to power through these. Am I being conspiratorial?
I think you're being skeptical in a very healthy way. I think there is a healthy form of cynicism here at work. But I would also say that it is precisely during these dark political moments that we need to be thinking ahead. We need to be envisioning the kind of media system that we would want to have. What is our ideal vision for this? And right now, much of that project, you're absolutely right, is not something that we can take. We certainly wouldn't want the Trump administration to suddenly expand a kind of state media apparatus. On the other hand, I do think there are things that we could be doing at the local level. We could be supporting our local news organizations, even as individuals, but also as through community groups. We could be trying to create community-owned and municipal-owned and operated broadband networks. There are various local initiatives that are trying to take proceeds from spectrum auctions and fund local public service journalism initiatives. So there are things that we can be doing, but I think most important, we need to be thinking for the long term, for a post-Trump America, which I do think will happen someday.
Bob Entman, last word.
Yeah, I think there are potential powerful counter reactions to what's happening now, and that all hope is not lost, as illustrated by what happened in Alabama. have organizations like ProPublica that are doing terrific investigative work, and there's ways to get that material out through social media that didn't exist before. I like Victor's point about action at the local and state level. These are still places where ordinary citizens can have an impact on policy and things can change. I also think calling on a lot of the charitable organizations in the United States to turn a little, this may be controversial, turn a little of their attention away from the suffering in the rest of the world and come back home and spend some money on democracy and education right here in the United States.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us, Victor Picard and Robert Entman. Really a pleasure hosting you. I appreciate your thoughts and I appreciate your research, and I really appreciate you sharing them with us and our audience.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. His latest book is called Scandal and Silence: Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Victor Picard, he's a professor of communication at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Media Activism in the Digital Age. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.